Session number 31558, reel 8.
And I thought I'd try and get some sleep. So I shut my eyes to sleep, and I'd hardly done that when they shook my shoulder, I didn't get to sleep, and pointed up, and there was a platform in the tree with the rifles sticking out over the top of it. So we crawled very quietly back to where we'd been, and we picked fronds of bracken and held them in front of ourselves, and we ate the bread that the Frenchman had given us. It was covered with blood, or we thought it was anyway. We decided not to eat until the worst moment, and we just sat there, and the mosquitoes were awful that night, feasting on us. And as soon as it got dark, I thought, if we could disguise ourselves as French, then we'd be all right. We'd have to walk through all these trucks. But if we weren't wearing uniform, they would shoot us as spies. So we pulled our battle dress out from our trousers and looked as scruffy as we could, which wasn't very difficult to do. And we walked on to where we'd heard tanks or seen tanks moving to the left in the morning and the afternoon. And we came there, and it was a village afterwards. I was told by the security it was Hotto. But there was houses, and the Germans were in the houses singing marching songs and very hearty, sort of things that no British soldiers would do. They might have sung Lili Marlene or Roll Out the Barrel, but certainly not that sort of song. And so I said, we'll have to go through the rubbish heap. We went through the village rubbish heap and had to go so carefully because it was very prickly and making noises, empty cans and things. And yet if we'd gone out between one of the houses, surely one of the Germans would have seen us through the window. So that took about an hour. And we came through, and then after that, we got going over the better, across a field and then another field. And then we came up to a huge hedge. And I knew we were back to practically safe by then, and my leg had got rather tired, and I was having to crawl to keep up with the others. But I didn't slow them up because they weren't going too fast. They wanted to go. And also, my morale had gone up very much when George, who was regular army sergeant, had said which way to go when we came out of the village. And I had said, we'll go left, and it was the right way to go because we didn't run into anything nasty that way. It turned out and I hadn't the faintest idea which was the best way to go, but the fact that he asked me, I thought, shows he's a bit dependent on me, and I'm not all that inferior to the regular army. And so anyway, the others were behind me, and they scattered. We came to a big hole, and a voice came out and said, "Hederhoch," or "Hachoch," whatever that voice they say, hands up. And they don't know what "Hachoch" means, but I think he's hands up when they're saying it fast. Anyhow, I didn't put them up, because then he said, "Mustard." So I said, "Are you English or German?" And I pointed my revolver into this hole in the fence, and he said, "English." So I said, "Come quickly." He said, "Be quiet, there's a sniper just up the hedge there." So we came quietly through the hedge, and he took us back to the platoon headquarters, which was a little way back, and they gave us something to eat, and some water, and some tea, I think, and some biscuits. And then they took us back to regimental headquarters, and there they gave us quite a good breakfast. And then they took us back to divisional headquarters. I knew we were aware that we were back, I didn't know if I said, because the shells from the guns we'd left were landing all around in that field. So I was not really being very brave and saying, "Are you English or German?" because I thought that they must be pretty well likely to be English. You know, when I was brave, I wasn't as brave as it might have seemed. I was just careful. Anyway, we got back to divisional headquarters. And then we saw the intelligence person came with me, and I went over with his 6-inch, the mile map, where the different people we'd seen and where was what. I didn't know who we were against. I didn't realize then it was Panzer Lehr Division. the SS division, the one of the three in the first Panzer Corps. So they were pretty good. And anyway, when I told him where the tank park was, he said, well, we knew there was one somewhere near there, and they will bomb them. I said, well, where are the bombers coming from? He said, Swindon. And so then they gave me a most enormous breakfast at divisional headquarters. It was really terrific. And then he said, the intelligence officer said, what was he asked? Oh, yes, about Hotto, where that was. And I saw that it was called Hotto. I didn't know, and I told him about the troops. They said, oh, we're working mortar there, and they're within range of our mortars. So it was 3-inch mortars, that would have been. So he took all that information and various other things. And then my crew and I, they gave us, with the help of a 3-ton lorry or a jeep or something, no, it wasn't a jeep, it was in 1500 weight lorry, took us back to the regiment. And they were all so pleased because we were the only ones to get back, except for Dong, and he did that very day. And so we got back to them, where they were pulled right back near Jouet-Mondé, or after North and Longeve, where we had been. And we stopped there, and the regiment was reforming. They'd had quite a battle with the Panzerlier infantry, and the following morning, the 8th Hussars had come to help them with their Cromwells. They were the reconnaissance regiment. I think it's right, 7th Hussars were divisional reconnaissance, and the 4th were for the brigade. I think it was that way around. Anyway, the 8th were the brigade. And anyway, they killed 400 Panzer grenadiers when they attacked in mass across the field. It was a crazy way, of course. Anyhow, so the regiment was in very good heart, although they were worried about the enormous number of casualties we'd had in Villers-Bocage. So my first couple of days after they put me in, the colonel had a sort of caravan thing where he kept his maps and things like that, and made out of a 3-ton lorry, and they let me sleep in that, and I slept for 24 hours. Then I woke up and then started feeling hungry again. We started to reform the regiment. We got some more reinforcements from England, and because I'd been instructed at Sandhurst, they made me in charge of a school by some barns in France. So I ran all through the gunnery side of it, and D&M and everything. It was just people who were batmen before and rather forgotten. They were refreshed, their memories were refreshed, and a lot of our transport drivers were upgraded to tanks again, because there were plenty of tanks coming ashore, but not really enough reinforcements. So after, they were from the 17th of June when we got back until July, we were retraining people and so on. And then by the end of that period, we were pretty well up to strength. And by that time also I got back to B Squadron with a proper troop, and Bob Moore was the troop who had the command of the Firefly. He had been troop sergeant, but he was promoted second lieutenant when we had so many casualties at Villers-Bocage. And he'd been in it from the very beginning, and he was never wounded at all. So everything the regiment went through. And he was driving the tank that saved me at the Knightsbridge battle. He was driving that, so, and I knew him very well. So I was glad to have him as a Firefly, Well, the first thing was there was a gap between the 7th Armoured Division and the 1st Armoured Division, our 1st Armoured Division, who were on our left, which was the eastern side. And so we were put to hold that, to just my troop was. And we got there, and there was a side road we came along, and I stationed one Cromwell pointing down each road of the triangle of the roads, the road running across the back, and the one rolling pointing downhill. And we hardly stopped them, and I put Bob's Firefly in the centre point where it was a sort of headquarters. And Bob's Firefly was there. And he and I used to take it in turns to walk down a ditch to look out at the wood the other side at the bottom, which was the French people in this village said was occupied by the Germans at La Belle Epine, I think it was. And no, it was Crowville, Crauville, Crowville, beyond Livry. It wasn't so far back as La Belle Epine. That's been where we turned off from Jerusalem when you tried to get to the crossroads at Tilly. And so he was in that, and we'd hardly got them placed when an armoured car of one of the reconnaissance regiments of the Armoured Corps came up, and the commander was a lieutenant to, and he said, he didn't know when he saw the tanks pointing down at just where he was coming. We weren't expected to be there. He didn't know whether to bail out or to turn round. Anyhow, I said, well, he said, the other down on the left is it was either 1st Armoured or, I think it was 1st Armoured Division, or 79th Infantry Division. Anyway, we went down towards that and we were whistling God Save the King because we were wondering whether they would think that we were Germans as well. And we came to somebody and we told him, and he arranged with their outpost not to move the Bren gun that was firing down the road. And I left the tank there, but I didn't, but to know that we were there. And we weren't going to come towards them anyway. So if anybody had come towards them, they would have been German. And if they'd come towards us, we'd have known they were German. But it filled the gap pretty well. And one day I was there at Crowville, and I crept forward almost into the village. And in this ditch, going very slowly by myself to watch it, and I saw a guy looked like a mortar because of from the smoke, firing from the other side of the valley, about 300 yards away. And there was a road at the bottom, but I didn't go down to that. And anyway, some armoured guards did, I heard afterwards. The next day, one was knocked out there, so obviously the Germans were on that side of the road as well. So it must have been pretty close. Anyway, then we were called back, and the regiment was then told we were going to take part in the Caen offensive, and we were going to advance down the other side of Caen. And we didn't know, I had forgotten that the ridge was Bourguibus Ridge, which was obviously named by some soldiers, not by my troop, by my tank crew, who were very, very sort of didn't use bad language or anything at all. Anyhow,
before we come on to that, what had been your state of mind in those days after the Villiers Bocage action, as you were trying to get back to?
Well, everybody was rather high morale at having got back out of Villiers Bocage and done all this damage to the Panzerlehr division. I think by now at that time we might have known they were Panzerlehr. But I think it was like that. the morale was rather good.
And during the escape, as it were, itself.
Well, I thought we had to get back. I sort of feel that we would get back because I was so determined. I said I was going to be safe all the way, and I wasn't at all safe. And I'm just stupid. It was just a well with water, we imagined, 20 yards from us, and then I let them cross the road and so on, and mistake a German armoured car. Yeah, I know it was only half light then, it was just getting light. But even so, it was not the way people were supposed to escape. So after that, I was determined to be cautious again. And I was just trying to think of the name of a gun, an aircraft, Bofors, of course. The moment you stopped, I remembered it. I wouldn't have forgotten it, I'm sure, if I hadn't had this heart failure in April. So really the next thing was the Corps offensive. And so I'll just tell you about that, shall I? Well, when I eventually got back to the regiment with my crew, they were near La Belle Lepine, about 10 kilometres south of Bayeux. And they'd had this... although we'd had rather heavy losses, having lost the whole of A Squadron plus RHQ, morale was very good indeed, because with the help of the 8th Hussars, which was the Divisional Reconnaissance Regiment, they'd beaten off an attack and reckoned that they'd killed at least 400 Panzer Grenadiers from the Panzer Lehr Division, the 1st SS Army Corps of the Germans. And so people were saying we must get things straight because as quickly as possible. And they set up what was called an academy, and we were training batmen and all sorts of spare transport drivers, any extras, because we wanted to make up the numbers. And they did make up a reduced A squadron of two troops, but we were very short of personnel, and there were very few reinforcements coming through, so we really had to make do with what we'd got. And as I'd been at Sandhurst instructor, I was put in charge of this academy for a bit. Before that, the first 3 days, I think, I spent writing next of kin lectures, letters to the families of RHQ people who were missing. And the one or two definitely killed, I knew about, and nearly all of them were missing, believed killed. That was about 25 letters I had to write.
Was there a format for that, or was that left up to the individual officer?
It was left entirely to individual people. I mean, they were not told to do this at all. Common sense meant that they might. So when we were in England, before we went, I took the names and addresses of the next of kin of all of them so that I could write to them. Oddly enough, one of the people who was killed, the driver of the RSM's tank, Hugh Trevor Roper, and it turned out that his parents, afterwards I learned this, were friends of my uncle. And so they showed him the letter they'd received and was rather pleased about it. He said, "Oh, that's my nephew." But it was all done on that sort of level.
What sort of thing would one write?
Well, I told what had happened, and that the tank had been knocked out and he'd been killed. That was all there was to it. Most of them, though, I hadn't actually... If I had, I'd seen them bailed out, but I hadn't seen people bailing out, so I didn't know. So that's why I had to go down officially as missing, believed killed. But until I got back, they hadn't really no first-hand information of what had happened in that sector of our very extended line. I heard afterwards how Arthur Cranley was very disturbed at the idea of pressing ahead on such a narrow front, putting a whole division down one road like that. Not surprising in a way that if the Germans knew about it, and they had the Tiger tanks available there, they would have used them. But as far as troop leaders and my level were concerned, we were told that the nearest German Tigers were at one of the other Vicarage villages, and that they were short of, ran out of petrol, which is what the French said, told us. We had no idea of Witten coming up on the side like that. That's why I was made just a mess of that business, because I was felt sure it was an ordinary anti-tank, anti-aircraft 88 that had fired up the side until the last minute, and there was really not very much time to do anything sensible. Anyway, after that, then we did some more things with the tank, which was rather, again, it was my tank that was taken as the as a test vehicle. And one of the troubles about the Meteor engine was the enormous, huge noise it made when it started up. Big airplane engine like that really did make you hear it a mile and a half off. And that was a long way for the Germans to hear one tank, and if a whole regiment starting up, they knew exactly what was happening. So we tried to silence it a bit by turning the exhaust pipes down to the ground instead of up into the air. But after it had run for a very short while, the brake pads started slipping and the steering went, and so that was no good. And eventually they did devise something of external chutes, but by that time we were clear of the Bocage country and it didn't matter so much. And another thing, we had the double sets, one set for talking to your troop and within the squadron, and another set, main set, where you could be on the regimental net. And so that was really was quite an awful lot to, for one person to manage two wireless sets, and you could easily say, oh, stop their firing at me or something to the crew, and you did on the wrong one. In fact, I did once, and everybody was terrified. I said, for God's sake, get a move on, having said driver advance, and he hadn't heard it. And they're firing at us, which is true, and everybody sort of jumped, and they said, Tony Jarvis, who was squadron leader, get on IC. So I did, and then it was all right. But it was, they were tried fitting another little small walkie-talkie set inside as well, so we could talk to the infantry. The idea was that if the infantry crawled down a hedge and found it was clear of anti-tank guns, then we could send the tank troop down and so on. Well, thank goodness we got out of that with this corn offensive into open country before it tried to be worked, because I'm sure nobody could possibly control his own tank, control his troop, and three radio sets, or wireless sets as we call them, at the same time. So anyway, that was quite good. And after that, we got sorted out, and I got made troop leader of number three troop. And this pleased me very much, because the Firefly, 17-pounder Firefly, was commanded by Bob Moore, who was I'd always known from the beginning in the regiment, because he'd been corporal then, and he was actually drove the tank of Dennis Hillwood to pick me up after I was wounded in the desert. And I'd got to know him quite well. And he was driver of the Firefly, but at that time he'd been commissioned in the field, and so he was second in command of the troop. And that was very good to have it, know he was there. And we got to know him, I got to know him rather better then. Well, while we were at the academy, we saw a lot of doodlebugs, V1s, that had gone astray, were flying backwards over France. And the Germans were shooting at them with their 88s, the anti-aircraft 88s, trying to shoot them down. And then I got a letter saying that our house had been knocked down, and from one of my younger sister. But fortunately, nobody was killed, and only my mother was injured getting down to the arid shelter in the garden. That's by broken glass, cut her leg rather badly, but she was not seriously injured. And when I went over to Dong Dallas, told him about it. He said, yes, that was horrid. It must be like bailing out of a house, must be like bailing out of a tank. Anyway, after all this happened, we had a short interval when there was a gap in the front line between the two divisions, two infantry divisions, one each side of us. And I was sent down to take my turn. B squadron troops went down for 3 or 4 days at the time. And it was overlooking a village called Crowville. I don't know how you pronounce it in French, C-R-A-U-V-I-L-L-E. And we're from the top. We got there at dawn and put our tanks in, relieved the other ones and camouflaged them. And we got shot at by some ME-109s, but they were very bad shooting, they didn't hit anything. And we were in position by the time it got light, and I didn't see anything happen the first day. But the second day, my tank was the forward one, because it was a crossroads, one road leading east towards where there was a big wood called Au Bois Saint-Germain, and so I put one of the Cromwells facing east, and one north, one facing south, Bob's Firefly back behind the house, and my own Cromwell on the slope looking forward. And I crawled down the next day down the ditch very, very carefully so I could look right into the village. And I couldn't see a thing that was disturbed. It was all absolutely quiet. And just across the road from that, easy view from my glasses, there was this big wood. And while I watched, there was there were two camouflaged objects on the side. I couldn't make out what they were, but they weren't natural. And I saw the puff of a mortar firing. So when I got back to the tank, I recorded that. And the next day, the reconnaissance regiment sent some armored cars in, and one got knocked out, so that they were there, but we couldn't make out what it was, and it's quite a big wood. And after that, went back to the regiment, and then I was told to take a relief party. We had a couple of days by the seaside, on the top of the cliff, and it was very nice. It was three or four German pack horses to ride, but only one saddle, I think it was. So I rode around on that and talked to people from the other regiments some in the 79th Armored Division, some infantry regiments and people like that. There was an officer's mess for about 20 people there. It was very pleasant and everybody enjoyed it. And when we got back, we found the regiment in a turmoil. They said, we're moving next morning, quickly. So we get ready. So we got ready.
Had that relief been the first break since D-Day that you'd had?
Yes, absolutely. We had no other relief, except while we were reforming. And then we went up north to the coastal road, and I saw for the first time the Mulberry Harbour. I had no idea there was one there. I could say, oh, they built a harbour. What a good idea, I thought. And there was a past gun pit with a very big gun, 210mm, I think it was. It looked about that. I think it was American. And while we were going past, it fired, and it really was a terrific bang from that. It was quite interesting to see how much sound could come from one of these really big guns, because we didn't in those days didn't have any ear pads or blockings like people do now. You see them holding their ears. We just had to lump it. And then we met a mustard gas unit. I met and talked to him, and they said, yes, they'd been over there. One of the first American units to come over to that part, but they hadn't been used yet. And thank goodness they never were. And then we came to the Orne Canal and the river, and we crossed by London Bridge, which was a pontoon bridge put up by the REs. And as we crossed, there was a field the other side, quite a big one, and it was studded with posts put in by the Germans to stop aircraft landing there. And there was a typhoon crash there, but there were all these gliders had landed.